Our guest on The Year That Made Me Today wrote the books that came in at number 17, 30 and 43 in Radio National's Top 100 Books of the 21st Century last year. Anna Funder's Wifedom, about the invisible life of George Orwell's wife Eileen O'Shaughnessy, was the highest-selling Australian biography of 2023, and it made waves all around the world, as indeed did Anna's novel All That I Am and the book that started it all, Stasiland, her 2003 account of stories from East Germany's surveillance state. In July and August this year, folks in Perth, Adelaide, Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne will have a chance to see Anna live in an evening with Anna Funder on Telling Untold Stories. And I'm very pleased to say that Anna joins us now on The Year That Made Me. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks, Julian. Lovely to be here.
It's great to be speaking with you. Now, born in Melbourne and spending your early childhood in San Francisco and Paris sounds pretty special. Why was that the itinerary and what was it like for you?
It does sound special, doesn't it? When it's your own life, you don't realise how special it is. My parents went to Melbourne Uni. My dad did arts and then he did medicine and he had a postdoctoral fellowship in San Francisco. So he and my mother and myself at three and my baby brother went to San Francisco and then another brother was born there. I think it was a lot less glamorous than it sounds, like, hey, Ashbury in the 70s, because one of my really abiding memories of it is my dad coming home one day and he'd bought this apron for my mother and it was meant to be a joke and it had written on it in big letters, "For this, I spent 4 years in college." And I remember my mother bursting into tears. And then they went to Paris after that where she was very, very happy and went to the Sorbonne and did lots of things. And I started school and he was working in a lab. So that was how it happened. It wasn't sort of globetrotting. It was postdoctoral research things.
And what age were you when you went to Paris?
Six. So that was my first year at school. I did kindergarten or prep in Paris. And my mother said to me before, we'd come from a Montessori school full of, you know, all the teachers had beards and was very laissez-faire in San Francisco. And then, yeah, it was the first year of school in Paris. And mum said to me later, "Look, I didn't say to you that you wouldn't understand anything. I just thought that might raise your anxiety level." So she sent me off to school in Paris. I mean, it must have dawned on me that I wouldn't understand anything. Of course, I didn't understand anything. But children learn languages really fast. And I think when I look back on it, one of the other things I learned was that you can be plonked in a very foreign world and it's going to have a whole other language and also different codes of behavior and people are going to think differently. And you will be okay, and it will be really interesting to find out what those codes are.
Hmm. Did you think of yourself as Australian through all those moves?
God, I don't know. I was so young. I'm not sure I thought about myself as anything. In France back then, so it's early 70s, nobody traveled as much as they travel now. And I do remember that the kids at school, I mean, they'd never met an Australian before. Being an Australian was really thought of as something very strange, coming from the other side of the planet, coming from another world, much stranger than it would be today, I'm sure. And there were the usual things of, do you ride a kangaroo to school and all of that stuff. But I think there was just generally a sense that there was something miraculous and strange about me turning up in Paris.
You've also said that you were raised to be crazily self-sufficient as a human being could be, but that you don't necessarily think that's a good thing. What were you getting at there?
Wow, you have really done your research. This is go straight to the psychoanalysis. I mean, as a writer, you really totally bring these things on yourself. I get it. Look, you can tell a bit of that self-sufficiency. My mother was wanting to do psychology, child psychology. And if you're following your postdoc husband around and you're in your 20s and it's the 70s, there's not a lot of opportunities for her to be doing her psychology degree. So she kind of had three captive children at home to do experiments on that had no ethics approval, if you like. She died a very long time ago, but I think she would probably appreciate the humor in that. And you can see what she's doing when she's sending me off to school. It's partly sink or swim type of attitude. It's partly hardening and toughening me up and saying, you know, don't worry about these things. Here you go. You're going to get plonked into worlds you know nothing about. I'm very grateful to that. I mean, I wasn't always grateful for that every time it happened, but you know, if I look into my small, dark heart, I see a kind of relatively introverted, sometimes lazy person who would just rather sit on the couch with a book than do almost anything else. And I think it was very good for me effectively to be told, you have to get out there, you have to see what you can see, you will be fine. And when I, you know, subsequently look back now on going to see all those, finding all those Stasi men, for instance, who had gone underground when I was in my 20s, a woman contacted me yesterday, an older woman, saying, I'm reading your book and I'm terrified for you. Sort of, what were you doing? And the answer to that is, I was being my mother's daughter and I was going into a world that was, you know, on its surface, not the most comfortable, but I had an inadequate level of trepidation. I really did. And that was how I was able to do it.
Yeah, so it definitely had its upsides. It's interesting that you use both the words hardening and toughening. Did you naturally gravitate to point on that spectrum that you feel was right?
I think that if you're writing, you're looking for what it is to be human. And I've done that in situations where humans have been put under extreme pressure. So it's almost like an experiment. What way will you decide when you are asked to betray your family or friends in Stasi land? What way will you decide when you could have a safe life with Hitler just come to power, or you could act out against him? And then looking at patriarchy and wifedom. But all of those things are just like sort of difficult situations in which humans are put. I'm thinking about what my mother did to me and how we respond. And my mother was a proper demographic psychologist who had sort of statistics and peer-reviewed studies to back everything up. I just go in and talk to people and then write about what they tell me it felt like, or in the novel, what I imagine it felt like. And I'm really interested in what it feels like to be human. So to your question, to do that takes enormous vulnerability of my own, because I have to open myself up to ideas that are uncomfortable or that are new, and to have an oversized empathic capacity so that I can sit and channel what it was like for a real person I'm writing about or a character that I'm writing about. And I think that that's how I am able to write, so that other people reading it can feel that same feeling that either I felt listening to the story or that the person in the story felt. So that requires a level of, I was going to say haplessness, but certainly vulnerability and openness to things, and not being hard and tough. But maybe there's a level of hardness and toughness that's required to follow through on an initial idea, to manufacture the self-belief necessary to say, I will go and do this crazy project and find ex-Stasi men and spies, or I will get into the archive or the coroner's court record from 1930s in England, and I will have the courage to say, actually, that reads like rubbish. Or I will go up against the Orwell fans and biographers. You know, so there's something, I don't think about myself as very tough, but then I look at those things to do, and for a person of not great courage like myself, they seem a bit tough.
On The Year That Made Me, our guest is Anna Funder. Anna, you've alluded to the amazing research work that you did and the personal challenges and risks involved in doing that research for Stasi land. I think that brings us to the territory of the year that you've chosen as the year that made you. What year have you chosen and why?
So this is going back a very long time. When I was 20, I had studied German at school. I had a fantastic French and German teacher. She taught both. And because of the experience in France, my family members spoke French. And because I was an adolescent, I felt it was necessary to learn something that my all-knowing, very clever family didn't know. And German was the option, so I learned German. But I really fell in love with German language, how you can stick words together to make new words, pretty much at whim and whimsy to express things that otherwise can't be expressed or that you haven't thought of before. And I love the literature. And when I was at school, it was in the 80s, and we learned at high school. So we learned West German literature, a lot of post-war literature, sort of anti-Nazi Group of 47, Heinrich Böll and so on. And we learned the East German literature as well, separately. So we were learning two separate countries' literature because of the division of East and West Germany. And I went to a Catholic school, so there was a big sense of social justice and a big sense that we shouldn't judge what was going on in communist East Germany, because possibly, just possibly, it was indeed a fairer system. Men and women
were said to be equal there. For instance, there was no capitalist exploitation of workers. There was no class system. There was no drug problem, no prostitution and so on. None of those things, as it turns out, were true. But we were told to suspend disbelief about it, which makes an adolescent very suspicious. So I went to the university and I did French and German and English. And as part of the German, I got a DAAD, which is sort of like a German, kind of like a Fulbright exchange thing. And I, for 87, 88, went to study at the Free University of Berlin. And at that time, Berlin was a walled city deep inside the Eastern Bloc. And I was there, yeah, at 20 studying fine art and German and film studies. It was very random. I was very lonely and very alone, and my German was very bad. And my kind of introverted hopelessness was coming to the fore. I wasn't really engaged in lots of kind of wild nightclubbing or anything that you might hope that I would have done. But I did meet, really by happenstance, a group of largely men who were a generation older than me, who were East Germans, artists and writers, and they had been kicked out of East Germany for running an underground magazine, for having their paintings, you know, smuggled to the West and exhibited there for whatever it was. So I would be sitting with these very interesting people at a coffee and a cafe in Kreuzberg, which is in the lee of the Berlin Wall, in, say, the beginning of 88, the winter. And over that wall, I knew, were these people's ex-wives and children and their whole lives. And they were vibrant and wonderful artists and writers. And I just thought, what kind of a place kicks out its best and brightest? And I remember one conversation where somebody said, what about if the wall ever came down? And this is early 88. And that bloke was laughed at, like he'd said something about fairies at the bottom of the garden, you know? And then I came back to Australia and the next year the wall came down. So I think that that year was really very interesting to me because I got to meet people who were living witnesses and examples of this crazy totalitarian surveillance state in the East with all of its self-righteous socialist human rights rhetoric. I was studying law, so I was interested in self-righteous human rights rhetoric. And then I didn't have enough money to get back when the wall fell. And maybe that was a blessing because I just kept my curiosity up through the 90s and went back in 97 and started what became Stasiland.
So did you have an inkling in 1988 when you were meeting these people and hearing their stories that that was something that you might work with?
No, I didn't. People will say, when did you know you wanted to be a writer? I feel more like I knew that I was sort of deep down in the same way that you know that you are uncoordinated or you're not musical or whatever the other things are that I do know about myself. I also knew I sort of was a writer. It's a bit like knowing you are Australian or you are whatever gender you are. I think really early on, like about maybe coinciding with learning French and being in this other world, language was a huge fascination for me. And I wanted to be in a world of words and I wanted to be a writer. Or I thought that I sort of was. I didn't know whether I would be able to realize that. It is quite possible that in an alternative universe, I would have never found the guts or the topic or the, I don't know, the sort of bizarre kind of vulnerability / self-confidence that it takes to write. It's quite possible to me that it, in a sliding doors moment, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But if I had to think of a sliding doors moment, I didn't know at 20 that I would be able to be a writer, but I didn't know that would be my material. But it was certainly great for me to meet people who had been writers and artists and were writers and artists and to see how dedicated they were and at what price they were going to continue to speak the truth and to show what they saw in the world in a beautiful form, whether words or paint. So that drive of theirs was very interesting to me.
And at what moments from the research that went into Stasiland are the ones that affected you the most?
There's a story that bookends Stasiland, and it's the story of a really wonderful woman called Miriam. And she was the first person that I interviewed when I was back in end of 96, 97. And I met her through the woman who was running the Citizens' Rights Museum in Leipzig, which was a very authentic, impoverished museum of the civil rights activists. And it was in the old Stasi headquarter building. And I was chatting to her. There was no one else in this museum at the end of 96. And she said to me, I think I know someone who you could talk to. And Miriam had never told her story to anyone before. And I thought I was going to get a story of a woman whose husband had died in Stasi custody. But actually, Miriam's story went right back to 1968 and trying to get over the Berlin Wall. And I can remember coming back from doing that interview. I was living with some lovely people in a share flat in Berlin. And I can remember saying to them, I didn't know if I was going to write a novel or something else at that point, but I can remember saying to them, I found my story. I have found my story. And they just looked at me like, you're a crazy woman. You've only got one story. This is your first story. How do you know? But I think you might have had this feeling too. You know, when you're talking to someone, you just think, this is gold. The story just absolutely resonates with you. So that was one moment. But at a certain point, I felt I had to go. I was gathering profiles of people who had resisted, ordinary people, not the famous civil rights activists, ordinary human beings who had just said, I am not going to go along with this system, even though it looked like the system was there forever, and the sort of political persecution that they then faced. And at a certain point, I realized I really would need to go and find some Stasi men to talk to me. And at that point, the statute of limitations had not run out on their crimes, and they had sort of gone to ground and were trying to get jobs in Western companies, trying to pretend to be Westerners, doctoring their CVs so that the university that they did their degree at wasn't evident, wearing, you know, tweed with elbow patches. And yeah, it was very hard to find them. I met a woman who said to me, they'll never talk to you. And I said, why? How do you know? And she said, because I've tried to get them to talk to me for my thesis and I got 147 letters back saying that they wouldn't talk to me. I ended up putting an advertisement in the local newspaper in Potsdam, which was where a lot of ex-Stasi lived. I thought this is a sort of shortcut. I knew it would be then a self-selected group of men who talked to me, but my German wasn't so fantastic. And I thought there might be acronyms that I don't know, like in the back of the New York Review of Books, where there's like all the acronyms that you describe yourself by. So I had it checked by a German friend and I thought the ad was pretty good. But when the newspaper was published, it was like the Wentworth Courier here in Sydney or the local Rag, if there exists such a thing anymore on paper. But they put this ad in the personal columns of the newspaper, which was...
What could possibly go right?
What could possibly go right? So in those days, there's no mobile phones and I was living in a very decrepit flat, which I loved, which became kind of a character in the book eventually. And I had a landline, so I just sort of stayed by the landline because the advertisement read, effectively, Australian woman seeks Stasi men, view conversation, you know. I think it even said discretion guaranteed. It was just terrible. And then my home phone number. So the phone ran hot and that was how I found the Stasi men who would talk to me, mostly anonymously. One of them actually rang and wanted payment, but he had been an inoffizieller Mitarbeiter, which means someone who was not employed by the Stasi, but who was a civilian paid secretly to report on the family events. And I would have loved to have talked to him, but he wanted me to pay him. And of course, I was broke. I was always broke. But also, I think something in me just thought, you've already been paid for betraying anybody around you, and now you want me to pay you again. I can't do it. Yeah.
Anna, you've spoken about Miriam and the impact that she had on you. I wonder if you could tell us about the woman that your novel All That I Am was based on.
Yeah, so Ruth Blatt lived in Melbourne and she taught my lovely German teacher German in the 50s as a refugee. So Ruth Blatt was born in 1906 and she, for upper middle class Jewish family, wealthy, and she had done a doctorate in literature on Hilda Lien, an amazing poet. But she was also politically left-wing, so not as far left as the communists. She was in the Socialist Workers' Party. And when Hitler came to power, she hung out a red flag out of her apartment. She was a newlywed in Berlin in a very fancy flat with beautiful chrome and cornflower blue deco furniture in 1933. And she hangs out this red flag, the socialist flag of the left. And then the SA come the next day and bang on her door and say, if you're not gone in 24 hours, we'll put you in a concentration camp. So Ruth fled with her husband to London in 1933. So she was part of a small group of emigre left-wingers who were in London as refugees from Hitler long before we knew the outcome of what Hitler was bringing. As refugees, their status in the UK was precarious. They had to write every 3 months to the king letters, which I've seen, begging to be allowed to stay another 3 months. And the condition of their being in London was that they not engage in any political activity, which is quite hard if you're in exile because of your political activity. Anyway, I knew Ruth very well for the last 17 years of her life. She was a really dear friend. She died in 2001. Now, after she died, I actually made a radio documentary about her for the ABC, which you can kind of pull up with her own words. But after she died, I was rattling around writing a bad novel. And when I'm lost, I like to research things. So I thought I knew all of Ruth's stories, but I started to research them. And she had once said to me, really towards the end of her life when she was a bit, her mind was kind of loosening, she said to me, she was talking about the dangers of living in London as an exile from Hitler, which I didn't understand at that time. And she said to me, you know what happened to those two countesses? And she drew a line across her neck to indicate the end. Anyway, I started to research this book just after she died. And what I found was there were no two countesses who met a bad end in London in 1935, but there was an extraordinary woman, a journalist with a PhD in economics called Dora Fabian, who was a member of the group that Ruth belonged to, the Socialist Workers in Exile. And she and her flatmate, an old eminent social democratic politician, Matilda Vorm, had been poisoned in very mysterious circumstances in the locked bedroom of the top floor flat in Bloomsbury. So I started to look at that story. And at the time I was looking at it, actually, I spent a summer with my family and small kids in 2006 in London researching it. And I went to the house and I got into the flats and I got into the bedroom and I did all these things. But that was the time when there was an exiled democratic politician, ex-Secret Service, called Alexander Litvinenko, who was very flamboyantly and horrifically poisoned by people acting for Putin one way or another. And he was dying. And I can remember that being absolutely horrific, but I can also remember thinking, Putin has stolen my plot. because as it turned out, the more and more I found out about underground Nazi activities so early on, knocking off or abusing or harassing dissidents in exile in 1933, 1934, 1935, the more likely it seemed to me that this poisoning had Hitler's fingerprints on it. So Ruth was dead and it was unlike Stasiland where everybody was still alive, and I really owed it to those people to write their real stories back into the historical record, which was forgetting them. So that had to be nonfiction. Whereas this one, I wanted everybody, all these characters who really lived, I wanted them to live again in the reader's mind. So it had to be a novel. And I also wanted, in a way, I wouldn't have been able to describe this so well at the time, but I wanted part of the suspense of the book to be that these people were risking their lives to speak out against Hitler, but they wanted to stay alive. So the suspense of the book is, as you see with all sorts of dissidents, Navalny or whoever it is, Thunberg or whoever, they are speaking out, doing what they're doing, risking their lives, but they want to stay alive. So that was how I structured the book.
We're speaking with Anna Funder on The Year That Made Me. And Anna, it's clearly your ear for other people's amazing stories and your willingness to engage with them so deeply that was the genesis of two books, one fiction, one non-fiction. In that sense, wifedom is quite a departure as well. So how did you and the story of Eileen O'Shaughnessy get together?
I do describe this at the beginning of the book, wifedom. I thought I was going to write something much shorter and smaller about Orwell. You know, when I was at a moment of kind of domestic overload and perimenopausal meltdown, you know, the sort of the hormones that sustain you and make you vaguely sociable and nice and caring and other directed had left me in floods, and I was a bit of a mess.
It was the end of summer. And if any parent knows, I'm sure you know as well, that the back to school time is incredibly busy because you're knitting back together all of these routines. And I had two kids starting at new schools and then a little one. And I had a French exchange student who was very unhappy and I felt very responsible for him. And then I had the script of All That I Am, a script that never got made, that was given to me on a very urgent basis. I don't talk about this on the book, but it was given to me and I was doing a rewrite of it in 3 weeks. And there was absolutely no way I could manage that juggle. The producers wanted to take it to Cannes and it was all urgent. So I found this fantastic young woman who was a med student who could kind of look after the kids that I felt I can sit down and I can rewrite this script of All That I Am. And then promptly this lovely young woman had a car accident on New South Head Road with the kids in the car, taking them to the beach. And anyway, it was just an overload. So I sort of gathered myself up and found myself, instead of going to a therapist or doing yoga or something, I turned to Orwell because I find it very relaxing. I find his voice, which is this sort of slightly disgruntled underdog everyman voice, where his persona is a bit hapless, I find that very comforting and I find him very funny. So I got a set of his collected essays, journalism and letters and read my way through those and I wasn't cured. So then I started reading biographies of him and I really enjoyed those. But then I came across, this is not an original discovery of mine, but I was looking around online thinking I might write something and came across these five letters which were from Eileen O'Shaughnessy, Orwell's first wife, to her best friend who had been a student with her in the 1920s, not long after Oxford first started admitting female students. She and her friend Nora had read English and she writes to Nora 6 months after the wedding. Eileen and Orwell are living in a really quite decrepit, a little hovel in a village outside of London called Wallington. And Eileen writes, "Dear Nora, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write to you, but we have quarrelled so continuously and so bitterly since the wedding that I thought I'd just write one letter to everyone once the murder or separation was accomplished." And I read that and I think I was just gone for all money because I just thought, here is a woman with this glorious way with words where she is both saying something serious and doing it in a funny way. What are they arguing about as she gets used to being a wife and her wifedom in these first few months of marriage? Why does she want to kill him, even in jest? And then, I mean, she was an upper middle class woman who would have grown up with cooks and so on. She is sort of going down and out, really, with Orwell. And then I thought, I've just been reading these biographies and she barely appears in them. So what on earth is going on? And I think that really set me off on following where Eileen would take me.
You've written three major books on really big themes. So, Anna, do you know what your next big subject's going to be?
I'm trying to write a shorter contemporary novel that takes no research. But, you know, wish me luck.
What are your odds? Yeah.
What are my odds? I have no form in this department. You know, that's what I'd really like to be able to do. And I'm not sure that I'll be able to do it. But I'm just working quite a lot and seeing where my curiosity takes me and seeing if it then has, I think, if it would have any value for anyone else.
And you're about to do a big tour, an evening with Anna Funder, and the theme is telling untold stories. Why did you decide to speak to people in this form, Anna?
I think that it's really, I think we are facing an age now where human creativity, so care for expression of what used to be called the soul, in a way, really looking very closely at what it is to be human and of how we need one another, what we bring to one another, what it is to be human, how extraordinary human beings are, is being kind of made a secondary question in this obsession about artificial intelligence, so fancy large language model computer programs, which have taken it upon themselves to literally steal the products of human creativity over centuries, if not millennia. So everything that's ever been written or painted, practically thought or said, has been hoovered up, broken up for parts, and then is being resold to us as answers to our questions. And it just struck me that whatever their sort of disparate value or their sort of oddity,
that's what I've really spent 30 years doing and making these books doing, is looking at what it is to be human in a really minute way. And I think that it's worth celebrating that. And I'm hoping that these talks are, they're really focused on the books and they're the story behind the books, but it's really about how everybody is unique. Everybody in an audience, everybody in my books, everybody that I know, we are all utter one-offs. And we live in an age of cheap replication. And I just want to refocus the conversation. I think coming out of COVID, it made me particularly aware of it. You know, we need each other in ways we don't even understand. And there's something about physical presence of a person that is wonderful. And I'm a secular person, but I really do think it has something to do with the soul. And I think art has something to do with the soul. Anyway, I'm hoping that these evenings, which are basically just me talking about the stories behind the books and the people behind the books and the making of art and courage and failures of courage I have known myself and all of those things. There's an hour of that just about, and then there's half an hour of questions. And a lot of writers don't like audience questions, and I really love them because I think that, you know, writing is a communication mechanism, and if people are going to read your books, they deserve to be able to look you in the eye and ask you what you meant. So I'm hoping that there'll be fun evenings.
There are evenings with Anna Funder coming up all over the country. And Anna, thank you so much for speaking with us today on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you so much, Julian.
And we always finish with a piece of music. So what have you chosen for us, Anna, and why?
Oh, yes. So this is going back to my Berlin days. So I didn't overlap with Nick Cave in Berlin, and I would have been too shy to touch the hem of his garment. But I've chosen Into My Arms because Nick Cave's work has accompanied me my whole life, and there's an epigraph from one of his songs in the front of All That I Am, which I did meet him. He once said to me, "I opened your book and there was my words." And I said, "Yes, but you gave me permission for $200. You were so kind." This is dedicated to Nick Cave, who I adore, and it's Into My Arms.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.